I'm sure it's not the same. Thank you. So let's begin. You went to Japan during the senior year of study at the University of California in Berkeley.
Yes.
And you liked it so much you stayed. Tell us about it.
Well, I didn't stay in Japan. When the conference was over, I went to China and spent most of my time there in Beijing. We all thought Beijing was the most fabulous city on earth.
What did you like about it?
Well, it was very much like Marco Polo's thought, I think. It had four gates, and they opened and closed. And they, and the town kind of had to come in. And it was very romantic, very dirty, and very cheap. So, 30 American dollars a month, you could absolutely live as if you were very, very rich.
You wanted to stay there.
I would like to stay down here forever.
What happened?
Well, first of all, at that time, the Japanese controlled Beijing. And they hated me. They didn't want any part of it. They didn't want any Americans in Beijing. And then the American government didn't want to be bothered with somebody in Beijing. They had no reason. So at the end of 1941, both the Japanese and the Americans come and go home.
The dislike was not personal to you, it was personal to your citizenship.
Yes, that's true. Yes.
You came home and subsequently were drafted.
I was drafted.
Tell us the story.
I was drafted and I was assigned as a radio man. I don't know why, but one day, I was ordered to report to headquarters, and I was scared to death. I thought I'd done something wrong. And they told me to go and knock on a certain door. And there was a major in there. My knees were shaking. I don't see the major. And he was so kind and informal. And he just asked me to sit down and read a little Japanese story to him. And I read it to him, and I translated it for him. And he said, "You're through here. You're coming again to San Francisco to open the language school."
The language school was an opportunity for you to
get out of there, as you say,
and then develop a proficiency.
Exactly. Yeah.
Around that time, the Pearl Harbor attack occurred.
Yes.
And then your assignment was?
Well, after all the students in the writing school except two were Japanese, there were two professors, myself and a very famous young man named Tobin Bauer. He was a well-known pianist at that time. And they couldn't stay in San Francisco because the Japanese Americans didn't dare leave the coast. So they sent us all the way back to Minneapolis, to an old man's home in Minneapolis, just a few miles out. And they started a new writing school in Minneapolis. I finished school there, and then went over to the truck in the Guam Canal.
The work in Guam Canal was part of the interrogation process of Japanese
writers and writers, yes.
Could you describe what the circumstances were, what the process for the interrogation looked like?
Well, the first prisoner I had interrogated was wounded. I took it as a compliment to my gut wounds because he kept saying, "Get out of here, get out of here, the Americans are all over the place." And he died before he ever was able to come to speak. But he was quite worried that he had enough I'm going to go to the next one.
Charles, when you look into their eyes, what did you see?
I lost track of it.
Let's move ahead about 7 years, 8 years to the Korean War. What was your role as a linguist and interpreter in the Korean War?
Well, of course, in the Korean War, it was Chinese, basically Chinese. And so it was the same goal to get a person and return that woman to China, the slave and the other woman, what that up to.
In both of those occasions, your language ability, Japanese and Chinese, allowed you to navigate fairly well?
Not too well. I do like Chinese, and I never became really good at it. And there are almost no Americans who can speak Chinese fluently. And you know, there came to the point when I'm not sure how many laws they broke, but they went down to Taiwan and got some young Chinese army who had been educated in Wuhan and things like that. And they brought them and they did bring them almost all of the Chinese.
When you say you didn't like the Chinese army,
tell me why. Because, in my orientation, it was not an exact language, and I've always felt that way. It's dry by being vague, and impossible to understand. When I was sitting in a school, we students used to put terrible tricks on the teachers.
Considering the vagueness of Chinese and the specificity of Japanese, do you have any thoughts on how the two different cultures are?
Well, you know, for a long, long time, the Japanese and the Chinese had their own language, but the Japanese had no written language. And they took power from there and borrowed the characters and applied the characters. And that's what makes the language impossible when it comes to the written part. The characters fascinate me because of the joy of pictures. The canvas of bird was originally a picture of a bird.
You were a lieutenant colonel.
Yeah.
When you became involved in your governor's executive campaign and the anti-war campaign in the United States and the Vietnam War, what changed your thinking to go from the position of a lieutenant colonel to
I was never really empowered by any of them. I was just a student. I was in the breakfast one day as a student of the pilot, and somebody brought me a fat envelope, and inside was a direct commission that things came very easily from the kids. That's how I got commissioned, just from the president.
What was the magic that you made to the war?
Charles, I'm curious about what got you involved in studying Asian and Oriental languages and culture in the first place.
When I was a freshman at Berkeley in 1936, I wasn't at all sure of what to major in. And I had a roommate who knew exactly. He was an engineer. And he got so tired of me griping about I didn't know what to study that one night he gave me the college catalog, a huge thing like a phone book. And he said, "No, open that. And wherever it opens, that's what you're going to study." So I took the book and I opened it. And of all things, it opened to Oriental languages. Well, of course, we laughed. But a few days later, as I was walking by their office, I just dropped in. And I didn't realize at the time that they didn't have any Caucasian students at all, hardly. And they practically grabbed me, and they got me interested in it, and that's how I got started.
Well, now, more than 70 years later,
yes.
What is your reflection on that as a defining choice in setting up a pattern for your life?
Well, it doesn't show much maturity on my part, but as it worked out, I thought it was an excellent choice. I wanted to do something different, and I think that was different, and it led into an interesting life as far as I was concerned.
Since your retirement from the Army and your retirement, if that's the right term, or perhaps your withdrawal from the anti-war movement, after the Vietnam War, you've become interested in opera and music.
Yes.
Can you tell us about that?
Well, after I retired, I wanted something to do, and I didn't really want, and I didn't need to go out and find myself a job. I had a good retirement. So I lived only a block from the opera house. And one day I went over and asked if there was anything I could do to help out as a volunteer. Well, here again, they just grabbed me. And I worked for them for over 20 years.
And that was in San Francisco?
In San Francisco, yes. Of course, I didn't sing, I didn't play, and I wasn't a member of the union. But there are lots of things a volunteer can do.
So considering your choice in developing a proficiency in Asian language and an appreciation and experience in opera,
yes.
Do you have any thoughts or suggestions for people who might be a little more than 70 years younger than yourself, not sure as to what path they might follow?
Oh, that's a tough one. I'm not sure that I could recommend such choices to anybody else. I really lucked out. All of these unusual choices just turned out for the best. And I think I was extremely lucky. The work at the opera was absolutely fascinating.
I think you just answered my next question, but it would have been, again, on reflection, if you might have been able to do something else or include another path in your life, either as a tangent or as a different route, what would that have been?
Well, I hate to admit it, but when I was in college, there was something I thought of doing, and that was going into the drama school and study drama. I wanted to do that, but I was afraid to do it. My family would not have approved of it.
It's so hard. I appreciate the opportunity to visit with you. And before we close, two questions. Tell me about an important idea or concept from your perspective that you would be considered visiting.
Being on one, I know I'm talking about. This is from the document. For a long time, when I was growing up, I kept thinking that before I die, I'm going to find the answers to important things like who are we, where do we come from, where do we go. And I kept thinking that right at the end, I will find the answers. Well, I will find the answers. There's no answer. And I know people, they just need, people want answers, and they have invented religions to get the answers. That's my own personal opinion. And some of the religions, the answers to me are so absurd. You know, I have to believe that you can be formalized, but anyway, that was
do you know what the credence is on a linear perspective of what I do?
Yeah.
And perhaps maybe as I do, some people are more complete with individuality than they are one religion.
Well, I did one religion, but I'm happy with what I do. For some reason, the answer is not there. Maybe someday, I think the answer will come to the science of the religion.
And finally, Charles Fogg, can you tell us about an interesting book you could have written?
Oh, well, I do read it for the first time, The Rod Quartet by Paul Scott. R-A-J, this is the Jew in the Crowd. It was a masterpiece in the state 10 years ago about the impact of India. And it's four volumes, about 400 pages, and to me that is the greatest thing ever written in the history of Zambia. And I just think it's incredible. It's incredible.
Well, Charles Fogg, thank you very much for being with us for a curious episode of Radio Curious.
Thank you very much.
Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious are available on our website, which is www.radiocurious.org. You can also subscribe to the Radio Curious podcast by clicking on our website. Our programs are also available in CD format. To get a copy, visit our website, radiocurious.org, for further details. And at Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and do enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org, and the phone number is 707-462-6541. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for joining us.